An angiogram showed a narrow lesion in his right coronary artery, which had been previously treated by implanting a stent. His cardiologist referred him to me for dietary treatment of several other arterial lesions, which were 60% blocked and not eligible for stents, but still of concern. After following the Plant Paradox program for 10 months, Vincent had another angiogram, which showed that all of the remaining blockages had been resolved, making surgery or other stents unnecessary. 6 years later, Vincent takes no medication, routinely passes his stress tests, and recently opened an off-Broadway show. A promise kept. Sonia R., a 58-year-old farmer and severe diabetic, was scheduled for an emergency triple bypass after having a heart attack. 5 of her arteries had severe blockages. In the pre-op room, she asked whether any other option was possible. After I told her about my dietary approach, she said she would be my best patient if I would not operate on her. She kept her promise. 3 years later, she has lost 40 pounds, is no longer a diabetic, takes no medications, has no chest pain, and has a normal response to my cardiac stress tests. Sonia now raises pastured chickens and goats, makes goat yogurt, and hauls wheelbarrows of manure and soil daily. Goodbye to diabetes. At 69, Howard L. was obese and took 8 medications daily for diabetes and other conditions. He had suffered a heart attack and was scheduled for an emergency 5-vessel bypass surgery. In the pre-op room, I could tell he was extremely anxious. After we spoke for a while, Howard told me that he didn't think he was going to make it through surgery and asked whether there was another option. When I offered him my diet, he jumped at the chance. Now, 5 years later, his diabetes and chest pain are history. He takes no medications. He has lost 30 pounds, and he regularly passes his annual stress test. An abundance of successful diets. Why are there so many diets? And why do so many of them work, at least temporarily? Do they have anything in common? Step back and tick off a few of the most successful and popular diet philosophies of recent years. Low-carb, high-protein, Atkins, Protein Power, South Beach, and Dukin, to name a few. Low-carb, high-fat, high-protein, paleo, ketogenic paleo. Low-fat, high-carb, Ornish, McDougall, Furman, Esselstyn. Each of these approaches can lay claim to immense success among its followers. Alan Levinowitz, Ph.D., recently parodied the popularity and success of these totally different diets in The Gluten Lie and Other Myths About What You Eat. The book presents a fictional unpacked diet, which is based on eliminating plastic wrappers. I kid you not. He cites websites to visit, pretends to sell products, and provides testimonials from patients. After you avidly read the multiple arguments Levinowitz makes in support of his program, you are suddenly confronted with the fact that he carefully cherry-picked his data, used other diet gurus' own words, and stole testimonials from most of the wildly different programs listed above about the great results. The joke is seemingly on us. But what Levinowitz misses is the fact that all the data he quotes about the dangers of plastics are actually true, as you learned in the last chapter. I've had the privilege of treating a number of patients who were firm adopters of each of the above-mentioned programs. They may have controlled their weight, yet they continued to have troubling medical issues, including advancing coronary artery disease and autoimmune disease, to name just two. Let's dig deeper into what really happens on these diet programs. The problem with most low-carb diets. A low-carbohydrate diet, think Atkins or South Beach, often works well in the short term. Heck, It worked well for me initially. However, if and when you return to eating significant amounts of lectin containing carbohydrates, those lost pounds usually make a comeback. Even if you stick with the program, your weight loss typically stops or slows significantly at a certain point. All low-carb plans are inherently high-protein diets, and thus restrict carbohydrates, all grains and legumes, and with them, their lectin load. When the South Beach and Atkins diets reintroduce grains and beans in the maintenance phase, and people invariably start to gain weight, what is suggested? You guessed it. Go back to the first phase and cut out grains and beans. The paleo concept takes the high-protein diet a step further and is based on the faulty assumption that early man dined on buffalo and other large animals on a regular basis, and that's what made us healthy. In all likelihood, such kills were hardly a regular occurrence. Instead, our forefathers likely subsisted mostly on tubers, berries, nuts, and animal protein sources such as fish, lizards, snails, insects, and small rodents. Now, don't get me wrong. Our ancestral diet was designed to do what any diet does, ensure that you grow up, reproduce, and then get out of the way. Your genes designed the ancestral diet to make you an ancestor, if you get my drift. Enabling you to live long is counterproductive to maximizing the number of humans being born, just as making cars that last forever is counterproductive for the automobile industry. I hate to break it to you, but any success you may have experienced on the paleo diet or another low-carb plan, whether it was weight loss or improved health, was not the result of restricting carbohydrates and eating lots of protein and fat. Rather, any positive response was the result of, guess what, eliminating most lectin-containing foods. Don't forget that the paleo concept is defined by what our Stone Age ancestors supposedly ate 100,000 years ago. Finally, my paleo colleagues somehow don't realize that all of our ancestors were originally from Africa and never encountered any lectin-containing food from the Americas. Sorry, folks, but tomatoes, zucchini noodles, bell peppers, goji berries, peanuts, cashews, sunflower seeds, and chia or pumpkin seeds are not ancestral foods, and they are loaded with lectins. Another approach to restricting carbs. A ketogenic diet, which is traditionally prescribed to help people, including children with diabetes, moderate their blood sugar and insulin levels, is also a low-carbohydrate diet, but with a significant difference. Instead of replacing most carbohydrates with protein, a true ketogenic diet also limits protein, relying instead on certain fats for the majority of calories. Ketosis refers to burning fat rather than glucose from carbohydrates for energy. If you limit certain animal protein intake, as the Plant Paradox program does, you will almost certainly lose weight. And when I limit it even more with a modified ketogenic version of the Plant Paradox program, I see remarkable success not only with patients with diabetes or who are extremely insulin resistant, but also with those suffering from cancer, dementia, Parkinson's disease, autoimmune disease, and a number of gut diseases. Chapter 10 addresses this modification. The question is, are most people on a ketogenic diet in ketosis, and is that why they are losing weight? The answer from my patients' laboratory assessments is a resounding no. So, why the weight loss? Once more, removal of the vast majority of lectins from their diet, not the addition of fat, made the difference. Hold the fat and push the whole grains. Do people lose weight on low-fat whole grain diets, such as those from Ornish, Esselstyn, and T. Colin Campbell, the China study. Indeed, they do. I've seen a lot of them as patients, because although they did lose weight, these diets failed to halt the progression of their coronary artery disease. But why the weight loss? I think it is the result of four factors. They remove the lectin-containing fats so prevalent in our American diet, namely soy, peanut, cottonseed, sunflower, and canola, all of which not only contain lectins, but are also extremely high in polyunsaturated omega-6 fats, which are used by our TLRs to incite the inflammatory cascade. Inflammation equals war, equals store fat near the war zone, in the coronary arteries. Because they have eliminated fats, low-fat diets do not allow LPSs, which have to travel on long-chain saturated fatty acids to sneak through the gut wall, where they would cause inflammation. That is a good thing. But the well-meaning physicians who had once demonized all fat and championed low-fat diets have come to realize that all fat is not the same. Fish oil is now an integral part of Dr. Dean Ornish's program, and Dr. Joel Fuhrman has made fatty nuts an important part of his diet. Luckily, neither of these regimens allows lectins to cross the gut barrier, so they are safe. They use whole, unprocessed grains, not ground-up whole grains. Now, I feel a little like Mark Antony here, when he said, "I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him." So why am I defending whole grains? First, most whole-grain foods are not actually whole grains, but are ground-up versions. Do you ever actually see a lot of whole grains in that piece of bread or cracker? Their lectins have already been released, and as a double whammy, their fats are treated with BHT to prevent oxidation. These physicians have correctly focused on organic grains, which are far more likely to be untouched by Roundup and the resulting death of the normal gut bugs. As a result, the diets enable the gut to handle gluten and prevent gang members from moving into the void created by that herbicide. And then there's this sad fact. These diets are generally intolerable, so you don't eat much. Even the Kellogg brothers couldn't get their sanitarium guests to eat whole grains, hence the birth of Kellogg's Corn Flakes, ground-up grains. A review of Dr. Esselstyn's original study shows a 50% dropout rate. It's not a diet you can live with, so any positive results in terms of weight loss may be short-lived. Why have the followers of these programs who have become my patients found that their coronary artery disease had progressed? The WGA in wheat continued to bind to the endothelial lining of their coronary arteries, which their immune system attacked. If you ever wondered why the southern Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans, all of whose staple grain is rice, have lower heart disease rates than Americans, remember this. Rice contains no WGA. Nor does the taro root the Katavans eat in abundance. Likewise, the millet, sorghum, and yams that are African staples contain no WGA. What we share with elephants. Want one more shocker about grasses and grains? In the wild, where they dine only on the leaves of trees, like our forebears, African elephants have no known coronary artery disease. Due to habitat destruction, however, herds of elephants now graze on grasslands or are fed hay and grains. These animals have a 50% rate of severe coronary artery disease, thanks to the lectins they were never designed to eat, which binds to their arteries and incite an attack. It is now time to reveal which sugar molecule the WGA and other lectins are after. As it turns out, there's a particular sugar molecule that elephants and humans possess that causes this problem. This lectin-binding sugar, called 5-AC, sits on the lining of blood vessels and the absorptive cells on the gut wall, known as enterocytes. Most mammals have a sugar molecule called 5-GC on the lining of their gut wall and blood vessel walls. But humans lost the ability to make this molecule at the time our species diverged from chimps and gorillas 8 million years ago. Instead, we make the lectin-binding 5-AC, a characteristic shared with shellfish, mollusks, chickens, and elephants. Yes, strange bedfellows. Lectins, and particularly grain lectins, bind to 5-AC, but cannot bind to 5-GC. This explains why captive chimps eating a human grain-based diet don't get atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, or autoimmune disease, but the poor grass-eating elephants do get coronary artery disease. The chimps lack the lectin-binding sugar molecule, but elephants and humans possess it, and it gives us heart and autoimmune diseases in spades when we eat lectins in grasses and seeds. The anti-aging approach. Remember, your goal is to eat a life-enhancing diet, not just one that will help you shed excess pounds and keep them off. A serious problem with any low-carb or ancestral dietary approach is that consuming significant amounts of certain animal protein, particularly red meats, is known to be a major trigger of aging as well as of atherosclerosis and cancer. How so? Back to our old friend 5-AC. Stay with me as it gets more complex before I can simplify it. Cattle, pigs, and sheep all carry 5-GC, which your immune system recognizes as foreign when you eat their meat. Now, 5-GC looks a lot like 5-AC. The barcodes are nearly identical. There is significant data suggesting that when your immune system is exposed to the foreign sugar molecule 5-GC from red meat, we develop an antibody to the lining of our own blood vessels, which has 5-AC. This causes the antibody to attach to the lining of our blood vessels, mistaking our own naturally occurring 5-AC for the 5-GC we've consumed and calling in a full-fledged attack from our immune system. This is the perfect example of friendly fire, and it provides further proof why shellfish, mollusk, and fish eaters have better heart health than meat eaters. Furthermore, it has been shown that cancer cells use 5-GC to attract blood vessel growth towards them via production of a hormone called vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF, which I measure in all my patients. VEGF production is promoted by an immune attack on 5-GC. Cancer cells even used 5-GC to hide from our immune cells, essentially cloaking themselves in an invisible shield. What's more, human tumors contain large amounts of 5-GC, despite the fact that we have no genes to manufacture it. That means the tumor cells got it from that beef, pork, or lamb you ate and nowhere else. In plain English, the reason to avoid red meats is to avoid an autoimmune attack that promotes heart disease and cancer, all because of a genetic mutation of a lectin-attracting sugar molecule that's found in humans. A diet low in any animal protein has been shown to extend life, as will be discussed in Chapter 9. So, a certain amount of animal protein is the actual mischief maker when it comes to longevity. This means certain carbs, those without lectins, or with lectins with which your microbes have been familiar for millennia, are not as problematic as the Atkins and Paleo folks have taught you, as long as you minimize certain animal proteins. And hastening the aging process is not the only result of eating excessive amounts of protein. Remember, eating simple sugars increases production of insulin, the fat storage hormone, just as eating fat boosts the level of leptin, the hormone that signals your brain when you are full. But you may not know that when you consume sugars, along with certain proteins more prevalent in animals than plants, they stimulate cells' ultimate aging receptor, which senses energy availability. We will discuss this aging receptor in Chapter 9. Energy, think food, is usually available cyclically based on the circadian rhythms of seasons and daylight. If energy is plentiful, then it is time to grow and make things, meaning babies. When energy is scarce, it is time to batten down the hatches, get rid of hangers-on, and wait things out. During scarce times, we use the fat we stored. Meanwhile, our mitochondria switch from sugar, glucose burning, to fat burning, in what is called metabolic flexibility. Most of my patients with multiple diseases have lost all metabolic flexibility. This means that a diet high in both sugars and protein encourages weight gain and makes a person more susceptible to disease, and therefore could and indeed does reduce lifespan, but also health span and life enhancement. Here's another paradox for you. Your genes want you to reproduce and replace yourself. Once that happens, your genes couldn't care less how long you live. Okay, you do need enough time to get your offspring to the point where they are able to survive on their own, and then they do everything they can to get out of the way. That middle-aged spread is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. We are supposed to die off once we replace ourselves. But if we want to live as long and healthy a life as possible, we need to eat differently. A paleo diet that endures. Let's return to my previous conundrum, the Catawbans, a small tribe of farmers who inhabit an equally small island in Papua New Guinea. According to Swedish physician Stefan Lindeberg, who has been studying the tribe's diet for decades, the Catawbans obtain 60% of their calories from carbohydrates, 30% from fat, most of it saturated fat, and only 10% from protein. Most of the islanders smoke. They are not very active, but they live well into their 90s without medical care. Their diet seems to contradict most of the conventional assumptions about what constitutes a healthy diet, and yet the tribe seems untouched by most of the diseases of modern man. Lindeberg's study, in which he matched 220 Catawbans with as many Swedish subjects of the same age and gender, provided provocative results. Catawban men aged 20 and older had a lower body mass index, BMI, lower blood pressure, and lower total LDL, bad cholesterol, than those of comparable Swedish men. Both groups displayed similar HDL, good cholesterol, readings. Catawban women over the age of 60 had lower levels of ApoB, apolipoprotein B, a marker for LDL cholesterol associated with heart and vascular disease, than their Swedish counterparts. Furthermore, Catawbans never experienced strokes or heart attacks. When is a carb not a carb? So how do the Catawbans stay slim and avoid heart attacks despite eating mostly carbohydrates and a large amount of primarily saturated fats, both of which are considered a recipe for obesity and heart disease in the case of the fats in the West? The answer lies in the fact that the carbohydrates that Katavans consume are primarily resistant starches, which gives you a free, well, almost free pass when it comes to their caloric content. If that sounds too good to be true, welcome to the world of resistant starches. This subset of starches behaves differently in your GI tract than do corn, rice, wheat, or other typical starches or simple sugars. Instead of being quickly converted to glucose, blood sugar, which is burned for energy or stored as fat, yams, taro, plantains, and other resistant starches simply pass through your small intestine intact. These foods are resistant to the enzymes that break complex starches, hence their name. That means you don't absorb the calories as sugar, which would prompt an insulin surge. But what is even better is that these starches are just what the doctor ordered for your gut microbes, which happily devour resistant starches and grow, meanwhile converting them to short-chain fatty acids such as acetate, propionate, and butyrate, the colon's preferred fuel, as well as a perfect fuel for neurons. Resistant starches also increase the proportion of good bacteria in your gut, just as a prebiotic does, not only enhancing digestion and nutrient absorption, but also fostering the growth of bugs that nurture the mucus layer of your gut. More mucus means fewer lectins getting through to rip open the tight junctions and start the whole lectin-induced cycle of weight gain and misery. In addition to not raising blood sugar or insulin levels, resistant starch assists in controlling your weight by reducing calorie count when substituted for wheat flour and other quickly metabolized carbohydrates, making you feel full longer and therefore consume less food, boosting fat burning and reducing fat storage after a meal. You need not live on an island and eat taro day in and day out to get the benefits of resistant starch. In part two, I'll introduce you to more sources of the microbe-friendly food and explain how to prepare them to maximize their benefits. How leaves become a high-fat diet. A gorilla is a classic herbivore, subsisting primarily on leaves. Yes, they do occasionally inadvertently scarf down an insect or three on the leaves. Surprisingly, a gorilla eats 16 pounds of fat-free leaves a day. But 60 to 70% of the calories the animal absorbs after digestion is in the form of fats. How can that be? Well, the gut microbes, good little guest workers that they are, break down the cell walls of plants and ferment the energy into usable fuel, principally the fats we just discussed, which the animal can absorb. As a result, the gorilla eats an extremely high-fat diet, just like the Katavans. Other long-lived thin peoples. I should mention that with the rise of globalization, traditional diets are increasingly given way to the SAD, or perhaps more appropriately, what is now the typical Western diet. But the Katavans don't have a lock on longevity and good health. Okinawans, Cretans, and Sardinians are known for their longevity. Although their diets differ, both also consume foods that feed gut bacteria. If you carefully examine the diets of long-lived societies, including the Seventh-day Adventists of Loma Linda, California, where I was a professor for years, a remarkable pattern emerges from seemingly disparate diets. The Okinawans and the Katavans eat a diet very high in resistant starches, from a purple sweet potato and taro root, respectively. The Cretans and Sardinians eat a very high-fat olive oil diet, while the Adventists eat a diet composed of 60% fat, despite being vegetarians. What could possibly be the common thread? It's the minimal intake of animal protein. Most of these long-lived cultures get most of their calories from sources other than protein. And even the high-carb eaters, like the Katavans and the Okinawans, turn their resistant starches into usable fat, courtesy of their gut bugs. We'll revisit these long-lived societies in part two. Blame pizza and chicken for fat kids. It's obvious that the American diet has changed dramatically in the last century. In that same time, and particularly in the last 50 years, we and our children have become significantly heavier. For her 2009 doctoral dissertation in the Urban Studies and Public Affairs program at the University of Akron, Lisa Ann Shelley Gittner explored the connection between the changes in the American diet and the rise in childhood obesity. Her thesis, entitled From Farm to Fat Kids, explored one of the unintended consequences of government agricultural policies, which significantly changed the food supply. This created a niche for inexpensive processed and refined foods, and their increasing use correlated with the growing incidence of obese kids. Beginning in the 1960s, the intensive planting of crops such as corn, wheat, sugar beets, canola, rapeseed, and soybeans made for a very different supply of plant food than was available around 1900. This shift in crops led to a change in diet from grass-fed meats and their fats, butter and lard, chickens that ate bugs, lots of root vegetables, and very limited amounts of fruit, to one high in polyunsaturated fats, sugar, massive amounts of fruit products like apple juice and other processed foods, and one low in vegetables. The increase in BMI of children over these years mirrored these changing patterns in food consumption. But despite all this, only two foods correlated perfectly with rising obesity rates in kids. Not surprisingly, they were pizza and chicken. In the 1970s, kids started eating lots of both of these foods. Just check out the lunch menu in any public school. The more pizza and chicken kids consume per year, the higher their average BMI. Although Gittner's focus was public affairs, not lectins, both of these foods are lectin bombs. The typical pizza contains at least three ingredients full of them: wheat, cheese full of casein A1 and insulin-like growth factor, and tomato sauce. How about the chicken? Unlike its forebears, which foraged in the barnyard for grubs and insects, today's typical hen spends its brief life eating soy and corn, and laced with the estrogen-like compounds arsenic and phthalates. Dip this chicken in wheat flour breading mix and deep fry it in peanut or soybean oil, and you have a perfect lectin and estrogen bomb. Eat these two foods on a regular basis and your lectin load grows, and with it, your weight almost certainly will as well. You now have a thorough understanding of how we got into this intertwined health crisis, thanks to subtle changes in your foods, personal care products, lighting, and a host of new drugs, and why your excess weight and health problems really aren't your fault. Now it's time to take back your body and your life. As I tell my patients, your body is the only home you will ever live in. If you spend the same effort on this home that you spend on your house or apartment or car, the dividends will last a long, vibrant lifetime. Let's move on to part two, where I'll supply you with the tools and guidance you'll need to achieve a healthy weight along with vibrant health. Part two, Introducing the Plant Paradox Program. Chapter 6. Revamp Your Habits. Okay, this is what you have been waiting for. Now that you know the science behind the Plant Paradox Program and what it has done for countless others, it's time to jump in and take control of your health by finding out what it can do for you. But before you get started, I want you to commit to memory the four rules that govern the program, along with the following statement, which is the most important thing I have to say in all of Part 2. Every time you waver, every time you rationalize something about what you plan to eat, every time you hear a little voice in your head saying, "But this is healthy food," stop and return immediately to rule number one, which I'll tell you in a moment. Let me tell you what I've learned from every patient I've cared for over the past 16 years as director of the Center for Restorative Medicine, which informs rule number one. What you stop eating is more important than what you start eating. My patient Tony, whose vitiligo was cured after he started the program, is a perfect example. When the pigment in his skin returned, I could have said that his skin miraculously normalized because my dietary program was extremely anti-inflammatory, high in antioxidants, low in simple carbs, high in olive oil, and blah, blah, blah. The creators of all diets make these kinds of proclamations. But quite frankly, most of this rationale about why a dietary program works is wrong. Why? Because it wasn't what I told Tony to eat that made the big difference in his health. Rather, it was what I told him not to eat that cured him. Follow the rules. These four simple rules will enable you to experience success on the Plant Paradox Program. Rule number one, what you stop eating has far more impact on your health than what you start eating. As far as I know, Professor John Suthill of Great Ormond Street in London, my old hospital, was the first person to state this rule. If you get no further than this rule, and if you actually follow the Plant Paradox food list, I can virtually guarantee that you will achieve remarkably good and sustainable health. Now, I'm not suggesting that you simply stop eating. Although the ability of a simple water fast to cure any number of diseases is staggering. But this rule does confirm Hippocrates' dictum that all disease begins in the gut. If you stop damaging your gut, you'll be healthier overall. Your gut holobiome accounts for 90% of the cells that make you you, and contains 99% of all the genetic material that makes you you. So what goes on in your gut, unlike Las Vegas, doesn't stay in your gut. Which brings us to my second rule. Rule number two, pay attention to the care and feeding of your gut bugs, and they will handle the care and feeding of you. After all, you are their home. Another way of expressing this rule is give your gut bugs what they want, and nobody gets hurt. That sounds pretty easy, except for one thing. Part 1 should have convinced you by now that most of us have a virtual wasteland inside our gut. Years of using antibiotics, antacids, and NSAIDs, plus the high-fat, high-sugar Western diet, have decimated the once-dense rainforest in our gut. A food desert is an area where quality food is unavailable, even if people want to eat it. Imagine your gut as a vast, almost uninhabitable food desert, where only the bad bugs can survive and actually thrive on the stuff you throw down to them. Remember Audrey II, the carnivorous plant in Little Shop of Horrors, who was always screaming, "Feed me, Seymour, feed me." Similarly, the bad bugs are demanding more sugar, refined carbs, and saturated fats. In other words, junk food. That's exactly what the bad bugs love to dine on, which takes us back to rule number one. Stop feeding the gang members what they thrive on, and they will leave town. It is as simple as that. Success story. Every little bit counts. 23-year-old Lydia B. had a persistent cough and sore throat, which her well-meaning doctor was treating with round after round of broad-spectrum antibiotics. She developed a rash, which her doctor called an antibiotic drug rash. When it failed to clear up, he sent her to a rheumatologist who diagnosed her with lupus and started her on high doses of steroids. The rash resolved, but by then, acne, weight gain, and mood swings, all the result of steroid use, had made this formerly vivacious young woman obese and miserable. Her story was classic. Her gut buddies had been carpet bombed, the gang members had moved in, and her own immune system had begun to mistakenly attack her. When I came on board, our job was to initiate an all-out effort to stop the incoming attacks from lectins, restore the gut wall, and rebuild the gut buddies. We started to rapidly taper her off steroids and instituted the Plant Paradox program. Within 3 months, Lydia was completely off steroids, the acne had cleared, the rashes on her face and arms had disappeared, and the excess weight was falling off. Her depression also lifted. All was well. Then one morning a few months later, Lydia came running into the office in a panic. By chance, I was sitting at the front desk filling out a form and looked up to see this lovely woman covered from head to toe with huge red blotches, the classic erythema multiforme, a symptom of an autoimmune reaction in lupus. She sheepishly admitted that she had had a piece of sourdough bread the night before and woke up with this gift. Luckily, a little Benadryl and quercetin tidied her over, but it was a lesson she'll never forget. Rule number three, fruit might as well be candy. Forget any idea that fruit is a health food. As you've learned, eating fruit in season allowed our ancestors to fatten up for the winter. But now fruit is ubiquitous 365 days a year. The next time you ask for a fruit salad as a healthy breakfast, I suggest that instead you order a bowl of Skittles candy. Go ahead. It's the same poisonous stuff. The corollary to rule number three is this. If it has seeds, it's a fruit. That means a zucchini, a tomato, a bell pepper, an eggplant, and a pickle are all fruits. And when you eat them, they deliver the same chemical message to your genes and your brain as a more obvious fruit, such as an apple does. Store fat for the winter. Moreover, and this will surprise most of you, eating the fructose in fruit causes your kidneys to swell and suffer injury, which can destroy them. Just to be clear, there are three fruits that you can have, so long as you eat them when they are still green, bananas, mangoes, and papayas. Unripe tropical fruit has not yet increased its sugar fructose content. Instead, it is made up of resistant starches, the things your good gut bugs love to dine on, but we mere humans don't have the enzymes to digest. Green papaya and mango are great sliced in a salad. Green banana flour comes in handy for making grain-free pancakes and baked goods. Our dear friend the avocado is the only acceptable ripe fruit because it contains nary a trace of sugar and is composed of good fat and soluble fiber, which help you lose weight and absorb fat-soluble vitamins and antioxidants. I've covered the next concept several times in part one, but it is so important that it deserves my fourth and final rule. Rule number four. You are what the thing you are eating ate. If you prefer, think of this as a piece of parental advice. When you sleep with someone, you are sleeping with everyone that person ever slept with. If you eat meat, poultry, farm-raised fish, eggs, and dairy products, you are largely an ear of corn and a pile of soybeans, because that is what almost all industrially raised food animals are regularly fed. The elephant not in the room. Why have I not mentioned how many calories you can consume a day? The old rule that a calorie in equals a calorie out assumes that you are absorbing all those calories. It doesn't factor in the fact that on the Plant Paradox program, your gut buddies have an amazing ability to consume a lot of the calories that you ingest. They use those calories to grow lots of little clones, either making the calories unavailable to you or changing them into life-promoting special fats that power you. On this program, you will make sure that your gut buddies get their fair share, which means you can actually eat far more food than you used to eat and still lose weight. I kid you not. In fact, as my friend Dr. Terry Walls likes to say, you'll see evidence of this with the large bowel movement snakes coiled in your toilet. We'll get into specifics about what you will and will not be eating next, and then again in greater detail in the following chapters. Your food choices will expand as you heal your gut, and your tolerance for certain lectin-containing foods grows as you advance through the three phases of the Plant Paradox program. But unlike most diet plans, there will be no calorie counting or carb counting. All you have to watch is your intake of animal protein. Feasting on corn. Corn is omnipresent in the standard American diet, especially in processed foods. Fast food restaurants rely on corn oil, corn starch, corn meal, corn syrup, and a host of other ingredients extracted from corn. When scientists examined approximately 480 burgers from a gamut of fast food restaurants, they found that almost all of them, a whopping 93%, contained a signature C4 carbon that indicates that the meat that comprised the burger came from corn, meaning the animal's diet was corn heavy. If that drives you to order a chicken sandwich next time you grab a bite at a fast food restaurant, hear this. The meat in chicken sandwiches were similarly made from corn. In fact, all the chicken served in the fast food places in the study originated from one source, Tyson, which feeds chickens corn and only corn. There is no escaping corn in such chain restaurants. If 93% of the ground beef in a burger originated with corn, the next logical question may be, how much of me originated with corn? Do you want to hear the good news first? It's less than 93%. Now for the bad news. Scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, carbon tested strands of hair from typical Americans and found that 69% was from corn. Even health guru Sanjay Gupta's hair analysis found the exact same percentage of carbon from corn. And here's the shocker. When the same carbon test was performed on strands of hair from typical Europeans, the corn content was a mere 5%. Unfortunately, there's even worse news. Most field corn, the type fed to livestock, grown in the United States, is a genetically modified version called BT corn. A gene for a potent lectin from the snowdrop plant is inserted into this corn to improve its insect resistance. And once that lectin makes it into corn and is fed to cows, chickens, and pigs, and then you eat those animals or drink cow's milk, it makes its way into you. This is a lectin to which everyone reacts and it's even found in the breast milk of American mothers. Another sobering point, genetically modified corn produces osteopenia and osteoporosis in chickens. And you thought only postmenopausal women developed these two bone deterioration diseases. One reason chickens are crammed together in their pens is that their leg bones are so brittle from their diet that they fracture when the birds try to walk. So ladies, the next time you take your osteoporosis medication in the morning and have a boneless chicken breast for lunch or dinner, ask yourself a variation of that age-old question. Which came first, the chicken or the osteoporosis? Actually, the correct answer is corn. Again, you are eating the stuff that these animals ate. Because our livestock have been routinely given antibiotics, they have become hosts to multiple forms of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Almost weekly, we hear another report of a meat or chicken recall because of an outbreak of deadly diarrhea. Wait, I'm not done yet. It turns out that chicken, eggs and flesh, pork, beef, and cow's milk are contaminated with aflatoxins, toxic byproducts of molds and fungi that grow on corn, wheat, and soybeans. These compounds are toxic to animals and humans, and their consumption has been linked to genetic changes and cancer. Cereal grains and soybeans, the type fed to poultry, are particularly subject to aflatoxin contamination. While the U.S. Department of Agriculture sets standards for the amount of fungal toxins that are allowed in corn, grains, and soybeans fed to our chickens, turkeys, cows, and pigs, there is no control over or requirement about the maximum amount of these toxins that are allowed in the finished products, the meats that we eat and the milk that we drink. And quite frankly, it's a staggeringly high amount. It seems that the USDA is more concerned about food animals consuming these toxins than humans eating these same toxins in animals. Think about that the next time you order a serving of chicken McNuggets. You might be getting a double whammy of aflatoxins from the chicken as well as the breading. Add a glass of milk and you up your chances of toxification. Success story. She'd rather switch than fight multiple sclerosis. Marcia D., a beautiful 29-year-old, was referred to me with chronic progressive multiple sclerosis, MS, despite taking heavy immunosuppressant meds and following a gluten-free, mostly vegetarian diet. Persistent brain fog and progressive numbness of her left hand made getting to and from work difficult, so she had to work from home. She had noted some improvement after going gluten-free, but some of her favorite gluten-free foods, like corn chips, potatoes, and tomatoes, seemed to worsen her symptoms. As usual, her blood work showed the typical pattern of lectin sensitivity and exposure to foods that contain them. Out those foods went, and within 3 months, Marcia was back at work and off the immunosuppressant drugs, and the brain fog and numbness were gone. That was 5 years ago. Her recent blood work reflects the banishment of lectins from her diet, although I do get the occasional phone call for help. I remember one panic call well. She had awakened one morning with her left fingers going numb and her brain foggy. "What were you doing last night?" I asked. "I was with some friends and had a slice of gluten-free pizza," she replied. Now, gluten-free pizza is a fabulous lectin bomb, usually with a crust made of oat, corn, or rice flour, plus tomato sauce and cheese made from cows with the casein-A1 mutation. You get the idea. I asked Marcia what she was expecting by eating that pizza. Her answer was that she was 33 years old and had to have a life. "Fine," I replied. "Do that and enjoy your life from a wheelchair. It's always your choice." She has never wavered since that morning. The buddy system. Back to rule number two, which applies to the good bugs, your gut buddies. Friendly bacteria are like neighbors who are invested in the neighborhood, your body. Your objective is to protect and encourage their growth. But typically, their needs and wants have been pushed aside in favor of the bad bugs. As a result, the good bugs are hiding in their homes, afraid to come out. But if you starve the bad guys and throw the good guys a lifeline, the good guys will reemerge to support the neighborhood. What's more, those good bacteria will start asking you for more of what they need to succeed. I've been amused and pleased through the years when dyed-in-the-wool meat and potatoes people come back to see me after a couple of months on the program, and they tell me that they now crave salads full of green things. In fact, when they go a couple of days without one, they are ready to kill to get to the salad bar. They are completely shocked by their own behavior, which is now controlled by a new set of microbes, their true gut buddies, giving out new sets of instructions. These good bacteria are saying loud and clear to their hosts, "Please help me take care of our home." The most important gift your gut buddies can give you is to direct your appetite and manage your cravings. This frees you from the constant battle to control your desires, along with the chore of calorie counting and the effort to demonize those wonderful-looking junk foods. Give your gut buddies what they want, and they will return the favor. Soon, the bad bugs responsible for those cravings will have left the building. Those unremitting cravings that often torture people on high-protein, high-fat, low-carbohydrate diets do not occur when the source of protein is fish and there are plenty of resistant carbs from greens and tubers. But the fats in high-protein diets tend to come from the lard in beef and saturated fats in other farm animals. The LPSs in your gut hop on these saturated fats to sneak through the wall of your gut. Then they are directly transported to the hunger center in your brain, the hypothalamus. There, the resulting inflammation in your brain sparks your hunger. The absence of constant hunger is one way in which the Plant Paradox program differs significantly from paleo and some ketogenic diets, both of which include plenty of animal fats. The Plant Paradox program contains only appropriate animal fats. And let me remind you that there are vegetarian and vegan versions of the program for those who eat no meat, fish, or poultry, or for those who also don't touch dairy or eggs. People who insist that we need to eat animal protein will soon learn what any gorilla knows. There is a huge amount of muscle-building protein in leaves. Not convinced? Just look at a horse. He didn't get those sleek muscles from munching on burgers. An overview of the Plant Paradox Program. The revolutionary approach of the Plant Paradox Program will help you achieve both optimal health and the ability to manage your weight by feeding you and your good gut bugs what you both need. We'll get into the specifics of the three phases that constitute the Plant Paradox Program in the following three chapters. Meanwhile, here are the basics, which you can also find in the enhancement. Phase 1. This 3-day cleanse begins the process of repairing your gut, fortifying the good microbes, and banishing most of the bad microbes. At the end of the 3 days, your gut organisms will have changed, and therefore your gut has changed. But you must move directly from phase 1 to phase 2 to prevent the almost immediate return of the bad guys. Phase 2. Here is where the Plant Paradox program really kicks in. All I ask is that you give me 2 weeks, and in return, I'll give you back your life. After 2 weeks, you will feel and see the change. It is that powerful. And after 6 weeks, you'll have ingrained these new eating habits. During this time, I'm going to ask you to eliminate or reduce certain foods and eat more of others. Here's an overview. Initially, you'll eliminate major lectins, grains and legumes, including corn and soybeans, which also contain estrogen-like substances, GMO foods, crops treated with Roundup, and many saturated fats. This includes whole grain products, which hypersensitize the immune system. But fear not, vegetarians and vegans. I have a solution for you coming up. Eliminate all sugars and artificial sweeteners. Minimize intake of most omega-6 fats, which prompts the body's attack mode, encouraging fat storage and hunger. Eliminate industrial farm-raised poultry, including so-called free-range poultry and livestock, along with their dairy products, and all farm-raised fish, which are fed antibiotics, corn and beans full of omega-6s, and laced with Roundup. You may have a small serving of nuts, guacamole, or simply half a Hass avocado as a snack. You will find that over time, if you are eating the right foods, you no longer feel the need for snacks. The wrong foods, on the other hand, simply make you hungrier. Avoid using all endocrine-disrupting products. Instead, you'll consume the following: all leafy greens and certain vegetables, and a substantial amount of tubers and other foods that contain resistant starch. Initially, you will give fruit the boot. Later, you can reintroduce it only in its real season and only as candy. Consume more omega-3 fats, particularly those found in fish oil, perilla oil, flaxseed oil, and other approved oils, such as avocado, walnut, olive, or macadamia nut, as well as medium-chain triglycerides, MCTs, all of which allow speedy repair of the gut barrier. Consume no more than 8 ounces of animal protein a day. Remember, fish and shellfish are animals, primarily as wild-caught fish and shellfish, which are high in omega-3 fatty acids and have no artery-destroying new 5GC, as well as eggs from pastured or omega-3-fed chickens. Only 4 ounces of your daily protein should come from grass-fed or pasture-raised meat, which have more omega-3 and fewer omega-6 oils than animals fed grains and soy, but still do contain lots of new 5GC. Consume dairy products only from certain breeds of cows or from sheep, goats, and water buffalo, which make casein A2. However, in general, with the exception of ghee, limit all dairy products owing to the presence of new 5GC. Phase 3, optional. Reduce intake of all animal protein, including fish, to a total of 2 to 4 ounces a day and fast intermittently. The Keto Plant Paradox Intensive Care Program, introduced in Chapter 10, is designed for those of you with diabetes, cancer, or kidney failure, or who have been diagnosed with neurologic diseases such as dementia, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, or ALS. If that describes you, do the 3-day Kickstart cleanse, then go directly to Chapter 10 and dive in. I'll provide instructions to determine when, if ever, you may segue to Phase 2. Glad tidings for vegetarians and vegans. My practice includes a large number of vegetarians and vegans who have asked for my help over the years. Unfortunately, most of them were what I call pasta grain beanitarians. Asking them to give up their usual sources of plant protein, regardless of the fact that these foods were making them sick, has been a struggle for them and for me. Fortunately, by working with my vegetarian and vegan canaries, I have found ways around the problem. Here's the first piece of good news. A pressure cooker will destroy the lectins in beans and other legumes, which are a fantastic source of non-vegetable protein, as well as in vegetables in the nightshade and squash families, actually fruits. Better yet, pressure cooked beans, shorn of their offending lectins, serve as a smorgasbord for your gut buddies, and can improve longevity and enhance memory. More good news. Most natural food stores and Whole Foods stock brands of beans and other legumes in cans that are not lined with BPA. Westbrae Natural and Eden Foods are two such brands. Eden Foods pressure cooks the beans in the can. Thus, vegetarians and vegans can consume small amounts of properly prepared legumes and certain other lectin-containing foods in Phase 2 of the Plant Paradox program. Unfortunately, the lectins in wheat, rye, barley, and oats, yes, the gluten-containing grains, cannot be destroyed, so these foods remain off-limits. But using a pressure cooker does destroy the lectins in other grains and pseudograins, making them safe for consumption. In fact, because the lectins are destroyed, their role in weight gain is also reduced. But please, do not introduce these foods until Phase 3, if at all. Remember, humans have no need for these grains. Let me embrace my vegan and vegetarian colleagues and friends once more, along with anyone else who wants to reduce his or her intake of animal protein. All that stands between you and true health are the lectins in beans and certain grains that can be destroyed in a few minutes on your countertop. Not grandma's pressure cooker. You may be disinclined to purchase a pressure cooker, fearing that it could be dangerous. Almost everyone who grew up in the 1950s has heard about a pressure cooker exploding and creating a terrible mess, perhaps even burning the cook. Pressure cookers from that era had just one mechanical regulator, which could allow pressure to build up with disastrous effects. Today's appliances are a whole different story. Thanks to a metal interlocking lid designed to withstand enormous pressure, an airtight gasket, and a relief valve to allow the device to maintain a constant pressure. They're also surprisingly affordable. Look for an automatic one, such as the Cuisinart or Instant Pot brands, which shut off when the cooking cycle is complete. For a hassle-free, lectin-free lifestyle, a good pressure cooker can't be beat. What is the right amount of protein? Consuming sufficient protein is essential to power your body and build muscle. And the protein you consume must provide the essential amino acids that supply the building blocks of protein you cannot make yourself. However, most Americans consume far more protein, particularly animal protein, than they need. Government subsidies of corn, other grains, and soybeans that are fed to industrial farmed animals, poultry, and even fish mean that animal protein has become ridiculously inexpensive. No matter how cheap, no one needs to eat a pound of sirloin at a sitting. As we've discussed, overconsuming and then having to metabolize large amounts of protein into sugar is associated with higher blood sugar levels, obesity, and a shorter lifespan. Moreover, certain amino acids in animal protein, methionine, leucine, and isoleucine, seem to be real culprits for promoting rapid aging and cancer growth. So, how much protein do you actually need? Most protein recommendations are based not on your weight, but on your lean body mass, which requires a number of complex calculations to ascertain. But to make it really easy, both Dr. Walter Longo of the Longevity Institute at the University of Southern California and I agree that people require only 0.37 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. Since 1 kilogram equals 2.2 pounds, a 150-pound man needs about 25 grams of protein daily, and a 125-pound woman about 21 grams. You can calculate this for yourself by dividing your weight in pounds by 2.2 to get your weight in kilograms,